Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendowed.org. The California Healthcare Foundation, working to build a more effective, compassionate, and just healthcare system. On the web at chcf.org/health-equity.
From KVPR, you're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Today on our show, a formerly incarcerated man who is now earning his PhD in applied math talks about what it's like to teach in Valley prisons. And later, the son of immigrant farm workers and a young high school teacher share their stories on another segment of StoryCorps' One Small Step. But first, rain. It's been a welcome sound this year, not least for agricultural researcher Jeff Mitchell, whose soils soak up rainfall like a sponge.
The water disappears within less than a minute, even for 4 inches of water.
He's one of many researchers working to make ag more resilient to climate change, which goes hand in hand with being water smart. KVPR's Carrie Klein brings us this story from rural western Fresno County.
Jeff Mitchell is a crop specialist with the University of California Cooperative Extension, and the quick-absorbing soils in his experimental fields keep the rain from pooling and overflowing, like in many surrounding fields.
There's the risk of that water evaporating if it stays there long enough, and even more serious, perhaps, is that the water wouldn't even infiltrate into the field at all, and it would just simply run off and go out eventually into the ocean.
Mitchell's water-efficient soils are the product of more than two decades of research into regenerative ag practices, including cover crops, planting grains and grasses between rows of cash crops. Along with other soil health practices, Mitchell's research has shown cover crops impart a wealth of benefits, including carbon storage,
increased infiltration, cooling the soil, reducing evaporation directly from the soil, and having water actually go through the plant rather than just being a loss through soil water evaporation.
Mitchell works at the UC Research and Extension Center in Five Points, where he's one of many researchers whose work on improving ag practices runs parallel with water efficiency and resilience in the face of a changing climate.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Good.
There's also agronomist Bob Huttmacher, who doubles as the center's director.
This place, it's been here since 1959.
The facility is pretty unassuming. A dozen or so low-lying buildings surrounded by big open sky. It's one of nine such centers around the state designed to bridge the gap between academic research and growers in production. So what they study here is a cross-section of what's grown nearby.
Cotton, sorghum, industrial hemp, barley, wheat, processing tomatoes, garlic, onions.
In some respects, alfalfa, this modest research station is on the front lines of climate change. It's on the valley's west side, where water is already scarce and the soil full of nutrient-blocking salts. And it has a history of being a little ahead of its time. For instance, it's one of the places where drip irrigation was pioneered in the 70s.
It was not always perceived as something that was important or cost-effective. But again, with all of these changes, water availability, predictability of water supplies, just sort of, pushed everything toward improved water conservation.
Interestingly, when contemplating climate change and the future of ag, it's not rising temperatures that concern Huttmacher the most. It's water availability. He thinks ag, writ large, will survive here. But for individual growers, the future is scary.
If you're not mobile and, you're tied to 1,000 acres of land that, infrequently can be supplied by a water district and then, by a couple of wells that someone is going to start restricting your use of, it is existential, crisis material.
That's one reason other researchers are taking a close look at some of the valley's most important commodities, like nut crop advisor May Cullumber, who gestures to a field of trees that are bare now, but in just a few years will be overflowing with nuts.
There's six acres of pistachios that were planted in May of 2019.
One of her projects involves restricting irrigation after harvest in order to essentially induce dormancy. The hope is that it can help the trees weather erratic winters while reducing their water requirements.
We want to try to find practices that are viable and maintain the productivity for agriculture, but that are also sustainable and environmentally conscious as possible.
Just a few hundred feet away, George Zhuang is tending to 2 acres of grapevines. He's testing new varieties of rootstocks for tolerance to drought, heat, and salinity.
We just planted those vines this year, so those are the baby vines.
Most of the world's grapes have been grafted onto a few universal varieties of rootstocks. Zhuang is confident that by finding new varieties of hardier rootstocks, the grapes we love can continue to flourish, even with fewer resources.
You know, here's the thing. Human beings, we have the talent and we have the research skills to adapt to the climate change or to whatever, you know, the challenges we have, and we'll still be able to make some progress.
Some progress may not sound monumental, but in a region with more than 8 million acres of ag land, even small changes are likely to make a splash. For KVPR, I'm Carrie Klein.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Staying with climate change, state maps may soon show even more homes and buildings at risk for wildfire. After years of delay, the California Department of Forestry and Fire Prevention says it's almost ready to release new fire hazard severity maps. Cap Radio's Chris Nichols explains why they matter.
When the Tubbs Fire burned his home in Santa Rosa to the ground, Brian Fees didn't dwell on his loss. He rebuilt. He didn't know about CAL FIRE's color-coded maps, orange for zones of high wildfire risk, red for very high. He was in the suburbs. He just assumed he'd be safe. Now, he wonders whether that's still true.
Climate change is making risk a moving target. Places that used to be safe aren't safe anymore, and firefighters need to understand and reflect that change.
The state's wildfires now routinely set records in size and destruction. Here's CAL FIRE Chief Tom Porter at an August news conference.
Fires are burning in ways that nobody has seen before. Yes, I keep saying that. You keep hearing that. But it is absolutely true.
What's also true is that it's been 14 years since CAL FIRE last designated zones where fire risk is high. Critics like Rick Halsey of the California Chaparral Institute say CAL FIRE's existing maps aren't just outdated, they're also flawed. He points out that in Santa Rosa, the Tubbs Fire returned to neighborhoods the state hadn't deemed risky.
This is what's so tragic. That area burned twice before, virtually in the same footprint in the previous 100 years. And so why that history wasn't incorporated into the fire severity maps is a mystery to me.
CAL FIRE spokesman Daniel Berlant says this time around, the state's approach will be different. Old maps focused on geographic hazards, like forests and canyons where fire spreads. New maps will reflect new science about climate hazards, including extreme winds that push wildfire farther.
The argument that we need to be mapping these areas and need to get on it sooner is real, because we're seeing more of these wind-driven fires that take embers into areas that historically were not even designated with a fire hazard level.
Berlant says incorporating the climate change has been slower and more complicated than planned.
We want to get the science right.
CAL FIRE expects risky zones to get bigger, especially in areas where homes and wildlands meet. That could make it harder to build in forest and foothill areas, according to Stacy Heaton. She's an advocate for the Rural County Representatives of California. She says the new maps will hamper local governments already under pressure to solve the state's housing crisis.
The state's telling them they have to build so many housing units per year. Even in the high fire hazard severity zones, they have to strike that balance between fire mitigation, but also building these low-income housing units.
And in these zones, new development needs wider roads, more fire stations and hydrants. New homes must have fire-resistant walls, decks, and roofs. And all homeowners in risky areas have to clear defensible space. Heaton says recent arrivals, people who moved to rural California in the pandemic, may not think about that enough. Overall, more people are likely to live in new risk zones. In Sonoma County, Brian Fee says local officials should put the map in every mailbox.
In my opinion, they should push it and not just passively provide it, not just it's available on, you know, page 312 of the county's website, but they should push it.
Fees isn't in a high-risk zone yet, but like other homeowners who've lived through wildfire lately, he's more eager now to see what the updated maps reveal. From Sacramento, I'm Chris Nichols.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. To round out our coverage of climate change this week, I spoke with Drs. Angel San Diego Fernandez-Bou and Jose Pablo Ortiz Partida. They are researchers at UC Merced who co-authored a recently published report on the impact of climate change in the San Joaquin Valley as part of California's fourth climate change assessment. A spokesperson for the Center on Race and Poverty and the Environment described this report as unbelievably depressing. And with that in mind, Pablo Ortiz, perhaps you could give us a kind of a high-level sense of what it was that you found about where things stand today.
Yes, of course. And one of the things that we wanted to convey with the report is exactly that. No? When we think about the San Joaquin Valley, many times we think about climate change impacting agriculture. But what we wanted to share is, well, sure, it impacts agriculture, but first and foremost, it's impacting people already. And it's impacting people in many different ways. The most obvious and immediate one is the rise of temperature. And this is considering both daily maximum temperatures, but also temperatures at night, which is something that we tend to overlook. And this is important because many low-income communities in the San Joaquin Valley either don't have air conditioner or don't have the resources to pay for the electricity bills. So this increase in night temperatures are also important because it prevents, in the summer hot nights, farm workers to just have a nice night of sleep, no, to get ready for working many hours next day under these extreme conditions that we already have and that more of those are coming. For example, some of the things that we put in the report is that these extreme heat days, in the past, we have had about 4 to 5 days with extreme temperatures, which often are defined like as temperatures above 100 or 104, depending on where you are, degrees Fahrenheit. And in 2021, areas around Bakersfield, Fresno, and Merced already experienced, depending on where the region is, but about 25 days of extreme temperatures. So we are way ahead of schedule. What this report was projecting, it's basically already happening now and already happened this year.
Dr. Fernandez-Bou, we've been talking about extreme temperatures. The report also looks at groundwater and the snowpack. Perhaps you could talk about that aspect of it.
The valley receives a lot of the water from the mountains. Precipitation is obviously is important, but it's not as important as the water that we receive from the Sierra. The Sierra Nevada stores a lot of water in the form of snow. And with higher temperatures, this snowpack is going to be reduced. And it also, precipitation will be warmer and it will reduce even more the snowpack when it drains over snow, it melts faster. That will release more water earlier. And probably the dams won't be able to hold it, so they will have to just let it go, and there won't be water available for agriculture or cities in the summer when it's most needed because of this warming of the snowpack.
Mm-hmm. And to add a little bit to that, if I can, this earlier snowpack and the less or the reduced water availability also means that we are going to turn even more to our groundwater resources. And then we extract more groundwater, further lowering groundwater levels. And as we have seen since the previous drought and now in this drought, there are wells that are not able to reach those groundwater levels anymore. And then we have what we call dry wells in communities and private properties. And this means literally leaving people, and we are talking about thousands of people in the San Joaquin Valley without access to water.
Dr. Fernandez-Bou,
the report does point to some steps that we can take to mitigate some of the damage and strategies to adapt given the situation we're in now. Maybe you could talk a bit about that aspect of the report.
Yes, I think it's very important that we act soon, right? But there are many things that we can do. And the San Joaquin Valley has a agricultural identity. You know, agriculture is the main economic activity here in the valley. And agriculture can be a great asset to fight climate change and for mitigation and adaptation strategies. So agriculture can be much more than only producing food. It can produce habitat for animals. It can clean water, clean the air. It can sequester carbon, no fixed carbon into the soil. And those are fantastic side products of agriculture that should be incentivized by policy and recognized by the broader society, because agriculture uses a lot of water. And it's undeniable, and we will need to be wise on how we use the water. But we use also water for cities, for health, for animals, for habitat, for nature. So maybe we can all work together and create these multi-benefit scenarios in which we can benefit each other while doing our economic activities more or less in the same way that we have been doing.
So Dr. Ortiz Partida, I understand that you have recently watched the film Don't Look Up, which uses a meteor traveling toward Earth as a metaphor for climate change and documents the frustrations of scientists trying to communicate the intensity of this threat to our planet. I'm just wondering, how did that film resonate with you?
Yes, that some of the jokes hit too close to home. And the first 5 minutes where the scientists are excited just with a sandwich, a cold sandwich, doing research, and then they get the discovery of the comet. It's like, oh, that sounds fun. It's going to be a good movie. And then eventually the downplaying of the situation starts. And with it, all these analogies that we can relate with climate change. And as climate scientists, I did not enjoy the movie, but I do recommend it a lot. And I think it's very important that many people watch it. Is we have been in the climate science side of change of things, we have been downplaying the reality of it and trying to deny the many impacts that it will bring. And many people doesn't feel that it's going to affect them. And that's completely wrong, particularly in the globalized world that we have right now. No, everything is connected. So even if it's not affecting people in some places directly, which is arguably, it's affecting people in other places. And that alone should be enough for people to want to do something and push our representatives to get to more bold policies that actually it starts to change in the course of climate change. And there are many things going on, and I recognize that from many people that is actually trying to fight the climate crisis. But we, from my perspective, we need almost everyone to jump into the same boat. No, like, as Angel mentioned, like, we are on this together, and many communities are being left behind. And these are the communities that are in the front lines of climate change, and the ones that need the most help, and these communities need our help. And in the case of California, relating just to finish the analogy, is we need to start advocating for the present of these communities, because that will help us to advocate for our future or the future of many people that doesn't feel that they are being affected right now.
You know, this topic is so overwhelming, and I think a lot of people struggle to determine what they should be doing and, you know, balancing, you know, individual action against systemic changes. And it just, at a certain point, I think a lot of people throw their hands up in the air and just say it's too much. What do you say to folks who are in that situation?
Well, that's a loaded question, no, because there are many people who do not acknowledge or do not accept climate change. And I mean, everyone is entitled to have their own opinions, but some public figures should not lie to people, no, because we have to be together in this, and it's going to be difficult as is, so we cannot be divided. Anyone can always push their politicians or their Congress members to do more and to do it better. And I think one of the most important things that we should do is to be aware of what's going on. No, what is the truth of what is happening? No, because we work, for example, a lot with disadvantaged communities, with frontline communities. And I know if people were aware of what's going on, they would do something, because I mean, good people are good, I think. And sometimes we see some early effects of climate change or the human pressures that are incredible. People who open their faucets in some communities and the water comes out black. That's not something that you would imagine that can exist in California. It's the richest state of the richest country in the world. We have the best technology in the world. We have some of the best engineering. There should be ways to solve that. And there are, but many people are not aware of them, of those. I mean, that's why it's so important that people like you spread and make people aware of these kind of issues, no? Because the first step is to know that it's happening and it exists. And from then you can choose your own path, no? It's very overwhelming, as you say.
Yes, and if I can continue, because now I'm remembering a little bit more of the movie, no? And one of the parts of the movie that impacted me the most was when Dr. Mindy, the play by Leonardo DiCaprio, asked himself and his team, like, why aren't people terrified? Like, what do we have to say? What do we need to do? And we put out a report like this, and I get that exact feeling. Like, we are looking at impacts that are already happening. It's not like it's coming in the future. This is not the comet coming. It's the comet is already here, and it's impacting us already. And it's sometimes so frustrating to just work in this space, but at the same time, so gratifying when you meet people that really understand the issues and are doing amazing things to try to overcome it.
And if I can add something else, I think is sometimes us scientists are a little isolated from the rest of society. And I think scientific communication and science-based communication is extremely important, because people shouldn't see science as something that is far away from them. It's something that is in their daily lives, and scientists should be able to convey the importance of what we do in a better way so everyone is able to understand it.
I've been talking with Drs. Angel Santiago Fernandez-Bou and Jose Pablo Ortiz Partida. Both are co-authors of the San Joaquin Valley Regional Report, which is a part of the California's fourth climate change assessment. Thank you both so much for being with us.
Thank you, Kathleen.
Thank you so much, Kathleen.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Between the retirement of Devin Nunes from Congress, newly drawn legislative maps, and the looming midterm elections, 2022 is poised to be an eventful year in politics for the San Joaquin Valley. What should we expect? I talked with Fresno Bee columnist Marek Warzowski.
Let's talk about this newly drawn Congressional District 5. Give us a sense of what it looks like.
Well, Kathleen, it's a very large area. It encompasses all or parts of eight counties, kind of from El Dorado County outside Sacramento, sweeping through what people would call like California's motherlode country, you know, into Madera County and then into Fresno County, and just capturing North Fresno. It's not a straight line across Fresno, but I guess I would say west of the 41, it's north of Shaw. And then once you go east of 41, it kind of goes up more to Herndon. And then it doesn't include any of Clovis. So just North Fresno. And also includes, even in larger numbers, Modesto and parts of Stanislaus County. In fact, most of Stanislaus County.
So at least in the Fresno area, the big news this week was that State Senator Andreas Borges announced that he would not be running to represent this District 5. And that announcement came after Tom McClintock entered the race. You know, he's a figure who's well known in probably the northern end of the Central Valley, more so than in the Fresno area. So give our listeners a sense of who Tom McClintock is and why his announcement sort of sparked Borges's decision to step down.
Well, I mean, Tom McClintock is a longtime congressman. I think this season is fifth or sixth term currently. He is a conservative Republican, has represented, like you said, kind of parts, not exactly that same district, but parts of it used to stretch up to Lake Tahoe, I believe since 2008. And before that, he was a state legislator from Southern California. So this is a longtime career politician. He actually moved to Northern California, you know, because it's, he picked kind of that area to run in because of, he'd have an easier time getting elected.
Well, I'm just wondering what the implications of these new districts are for the Central Valley. I mean, and the Fresno Bee wrote an editorial, published an editorial this week talking about how North Fresno really suffers in terms of representation as a result of the way the districts were drawn. Can you just weigh in on that a little bit?
Well, sure. I mean, that's pretty easy. The Citizens Redistrict Commission of California didn't do Fresno County any favors at all when it redrew its lines for this decade. And, you know, we're talking about the congressional districts now, but it also applies to assembly districts and state senate districts, which we could get into if you want later. But with the congressional district, Fresno County is split into four different congressional districts. But only in one of them does it actually hold a majority of votes. And that is in the Congressional District 21, which where Jim Costa is going to be running for re-election. That district encompasses most of Fresno, pretty much everything south of Shaw or Herndon once you get, and then there's a little bit of a chunk of Fresno missing, but also Fresno County communities, you know, the cities of Sanger and Selma, Kingsburg, and it sweeps all the way down to the northern part of Visalia. So that of the four congressional districts in Fresno County, that's the only one where Fresno County is a voter majority. The other two, CD5, which we were just talking about, McClintock, Stanislaus County and El Dorado County, both have more voters in that district than Fresno County. Again, that's mostly North Fresno. And then in CD20, which is House current minority leader and people are presuming the next majority leader of the House, Kevin McCarthy, is running. Kern County outnumbers Fresno County residents, you know, 324,000 to about 200,000. So, and then of course there's another district, which is CD13, which is where Josh Harder is running for re-election. There's only a small part of that district of Fresno County residents. Most are Merced County residents. So again, we have four congressional districts, but only one where Fresno County actually is going to hold sway. So I think that is the, that's the message that the editorial board is getting out. And if you compare that, if you look at Fresno County's population and you compare how it's split up to other counties, it's not really done in a way that's favorable to us.
Well, let's go ahead and get into some of those down ballot races, assembly races or state senate. What are the ones that you're keeping an eye on?
Well, I think in the assembly, the Fresno County's primary assemblyman, Joaquin Arandula, his district is even going to be more Fresno County centric, in the new maps. You know, I think that where Fresno County kind of loses out is in the state senate races. The two senators who currently represent parts of Fresno County, Melissa Hurtado and Ana Caballero, were drawn into the same district, which pits them against each other in a primary. And then earlier we talked about State Senator Andreas Borges, announcing he wasn't going to run for Congress. Well, he's also announced, subsequent to that he's not going to run for re-election in the state Senate either. And the reason for that is pretty simple. Again, Kathleen, it comes down to numbers. You know, his new district, which is Senate District 12, has more Kern County voters than Fresno County voters. And it also has a number of Tulare County voters that typically side with Kern County if it comes down to a choice between the two. And also, you know, the former Senate Minority Leader Shannon Grove is going to be running in that district also. So, I mean, I think Borges saw the numbers on the wall and decided to gracefully bow out. So, again, that equals less Fresno area representation into that, you know, body of the legislature.
Well, let's shift our focus, or keep our focus back down on the South Valley, but move back to Congress. So David Valadao announced that he will run in the newly created 22nd Congressional District, which includes Hanford and goes down into Delano. You know, this is expected to be a competitive district. It's safe to say he's going to face his fair share of challengers. How do you think that race is going to play out?
Well, I mean, he is in a competitive district, but I think it's actually, you know, it might be even a little less competitive than the district that he won in the last election. You know, I think I've seen 538 call that district, the 22nd, a plus 10 Democratic lean. I believe it was higher than that beforehand. Well, it was about the same. So, you know, I know that district is kind of hard to measure, hard to gauge. I think as it moves further south, it doesn't include Fresno County anymore. I would say that now that it encompasses, you know, mostly Kings County and then down in parts of Tulare County, I would say that he probably even has a better chance of being reelected.
But given Valadao's vote to impeach Trump, I mean, is that going to help him or hurt him in this new district?
I don't know. I think it kind of helps him, Kathleen, both ways. I mean, yes, it's true that he might get primaried with a more conservative Republican, but, you know, probably not enough, you know, not enough to upend him. And then it helps him, I think, in the general election with, you know, people, you know, with, you know, moderate Democrats. So I think it actually might help him, although it might hurt him in the primary. But you know, he's made some statements. I mean, you know, today I heard him talking about flushing, or a statement on the, you know, in Capitol Hill about, you know, California flushing water to the ocean, which is one of my favorite political tropes around here. So, yes, he did vote to impeach Trump, but he's also making a lot of statements that are going to, you know, gain him favor with his constituents.
I've been talking with Merrick Borsowski with the Fresno Bee. Merrick, thank you so much for being on the show.
You're welcome, Kathleen, anytime.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Dos Palos native Corey McCullough has come a long way from a life of drug and alcohol addiction, commercial burglary, and several stints in prison. Now he's a third-year PhD student of applied math at UC Merced. He also teaches currently incarcerated students through Merced College's Rising Scholars Program. Here's our conversation.
How did the incarcerated students that you work with differ from other students?
Oh, man, that's an interesting question. So I think incarcerated students, first of all, they have a lot of free time. They have a lot of time to work on stuff, and it also translates into a lot of time to find every mistake I've ever made in my life. If there's a mistake in the syllabus or a mistake in the assignment, they're like, oh, you know, do we get extra credit? You know, so they have a lot of time. So their assignments are very thorough. And I think a lot of that has to do with a lot of the inmate students. Are a lot of inmates in general are people who have dealt with addiction issues, right? And so I think people who struggle with addiction are a different kind of person. Society kind of looks down on them, but they know how to survive in any situation, whether it be in some trap house or incarcerated. They've brought themselves down to the lowest, you know, almost animalistic type existence. And then they've learned to adapt. So it's not, I mean, it sounds bad, but when they get incarcerated and they become inmates, you know, they've already been there, done that. They know how to survive in there. It's very different rules in prison than it is in society. So they've adapted to that. They've overcome a lot of things. And so they're really more along the lines of people who have misplaced passion. Mm-hmm. That they put a lot of passion into, you know, doing drugs or doing crime or whatever it is. And then when they decide that they don't want to do that anymore, they want to find a new way to live, and they direct their passion somewhere else, they become much more resilient students. And well, they become really good at anything they put their mind to, right? Like I've told the students when I get there, like, I know who you are. You're engineers, you know, you're doctors. Some of you have, you know, degrees, and you go in there and they, you know, they can break into the power supply in their cell and connect wires and make a stick that heats up their soup.
Wow.
You know what I mean? So they know how to survive and overcome and adapt in any situation.
So in what ways does your experience being incarcerated inform how you work with and how you engage with these students?
Well, what it is I don't spend a lot of time talking about it. I'm just, you know, I'm a teacher. They deal with teachers, and they have college professors, and they have people that come in and they're like, oh, this is another professor. And, you know, some of them wear a tweed jacket or a bow tie. That's not exactly what they get when I walk into the class. A lot of them, when they've seen me walk around on the yard, and they know by the way that I carry myself that I've been incarcerated for.
In what way? How so?
Just because being in that environment, it's hard to say. Like when I'm walking around on the streets, I can see someone and tell if they've been to prison. Just by the way that they carry themselves, whether they hold their head high or their chest high or the way they walk, things like that. It's not always just tattoos and gang stuff, but I can tell someone who's done time. It kind of changes the way that you carry yourself.
Sure.
So when I get in there, they know pretty much right off the bat. And of course, they know already now because I've taught there, and they know who they're getting. But I don't spend too much time. I'll just say, hey, I was incarcerated too. So I get it. I relate. That doesn't mean this class is going to be easy, but I understand, you know, what it's like to be in here and what this pressure of being in here. So I'm kind of more understanding, I think, of, you know, if they turn in something late or they have to, you know, deal with, because all of the work they turn in, or most of the work they turn in, especially with COVID restrictions, comes through officers. It goes, and the more times it changes hands, the more times, you know, there's more availability for something to get lost. You know, and so I'm just kind of understanding. Some other teachers aren't exactly so understanding of that. They, you know, they tend to forget that they're teaching in a different kind of environment than at the college. But the way that it informs the way I deal with them, I'm just like, hey, man, I get it. You know, whatever you're going through, I've probably gone through something similar. Work hard and we'll get through this together. This class isn't necessarily, I'm not really going to grade you based on whether or not I can tell you something and then you can regurgitate it later. I'm going to grade you based on how hard you work and how much effort you put in, because, you know, I teach a math class. There's no math majors there. I would be blown away if in 10 years I saw one of these guys and they got out of prison, they could still do a weighted average. You know what I mean? This is not their major. I tell them if this were a room full of statistics majors, it'd be a much different class.
Could you explain how the Rising Scholars program works?
Yeah. So the Rising Scholars program, what we do is we just go, we contract with Valley State Prison and Central California Women's Facility, CCWF, right across the street. And there's been a couple colleges, you know, that kind of go out, they do what's called correspondence, where you can get a degree, but it's only, you know, they send packets, you fill out the packets, and then you send it back and you never see the teacher or whatever. So we decided that we were going to go in there and start teaching the inmates. So we went in there and I guess we had some issues because they're not really close to us. They're not in close proximity to us necessarily, but they decided they would let us go in anyway. So we offer a few basic majors so you can earn an AA degree while you're in there. They have a GED program, which is not Rising Scholars. That one's through the prison, but they have teachers that are there just every day, and they have a whole little school inside the prison with buildings and classrooms, and you go in there and you look at the classrooms and they have those inspirational posters all over the wall, and you think, oh, I'm at school, until you look up and you see the barbed wire, you know. Then they have, they offer GED, and then when you get your GED, you can come and get your AA degree in like psychology or business or sociology. So there's just a handful of teachers that teach these classes, and it just so happens that you have to have, in order to get an AA, you have to have a few different math classes. And I think they were having some problems with instructors before that were just, not a lot of people look at inmates as people. You know, they're like, well, I'm better than you. I'm your teacher, don't you know? You know. And so they really wanted someone who could relate. So I went in there and I'm teaching math there now. And so it turns out that Fresno State is going out there, and they are teaching, they're offering bachelor's degrees as well for some of the inmates, because they found that the recidivism rate goes down drastically when you offer education programs. So the students, there's a huge wait list because you also get time off your sentence. So, you know, counts as good behavior. So you get into college, you take a couple classes, and you you have to have, I think, 2 years of good behavior before you can even get put on the list. So these are students who really want to make a change. They don't let just anybody in. They have people at the classes at the men and the women's prison. And so, yeah, that's what we're doing. And the Rising Scholars Club, we just started a club at Merced College. We're trying to get some funding, you know, for students who are formerly incarcerated or students who are just allies of those who were incarcerated or formerly incarcerated. So what we do is we have this room now that we've kind of procured. It's kind of a big room. There's computers in there. People who are a part of the Rising Scholars program can go in there and do homework. They can do, you know, they can get on the computer, use the internet, print stuff out. And that's specifically for them. You know, they have their own space. So that's something that not a lot of other students really have, you know. So that's the basis of the Rising Scholars program. And it's not just for inmates. Like I said, it's for, or former inmates, it's for allies too. Like my daughter is in high school, but she's taking some Merced College classes, and I think she's going to join the club. So
that's great.
Yeah. So that's the basis there. We're looking, like I said, we're looking into funding, you know, for food cards or transportation, like hand out some bus passes or whatever it is, you know. We just want to help this underrepresented portion of the community. Because when it was me and I was going to college and I had these felonies on, I was like, I got to do something to outweigh these felonies. And it's not that easy. There was a few times when I was like, I'm going to have to sleep in my car tonight. You know, I'm going to have to drive my car over to Starbucks so I can turn this assignment in, or because they have internet there. There's not a lot of resources for college students in general, but especially ones who are not looked well upon in society. Last semester, I had a gentleman in my class, and at the end of the class, he was one of my better students, and he was like, I'm getting out soon. He'd been in prison for 25 years. I was like, okay, what are you okay? Like, are you, he's like, I'm scared. He's scared to get out into society. Like, why are you scared? He said, well, nobody accepts felons. Like, society doesn't accept people like us. I'm like, hey, who cares? You know what I mean? Like, you could only dwell on that for so long. I'm like, what you have to do is you have to go out there and use your story as leverage, right? You have to leverage what it is that you've done, and then you have to go and do something great, which you're already doing because you're in college, and then people will take interest in you, hence the interview here, you know, stuff like that. Our goal, I think, is just to kind of take the stigma and turn it on its head and be like, we're not pieces of, you know what? You know what I mean? We're not, there are some, of course, in prison, but not all of us are like that. You know, there's people in there that already have advanced degrees like PhDs and stuff, and they just were in the wrong place at the wrong time, or, you know, I think everybody needs an opportunity to probably change their life. But, you know, it's not, what I want to emphasize is it's not really just me. Like, I'm just a very small piece in this whole thing. I just happen to be someone who's worked hard enough for it to come back around, I guess. So what the real stars are the people who are not like me and going into the prison and teaching, you know, like Jennifer McBride and the other professors, Vince Pirro, ones who work at Merced College and Fresno State, they go in there and they consciously are like, I need to go give these folks a chance. Not only for them, but for society too, because the correction system is broken. It doesn't work very well. What inmates get when they go to prison is a PhD in crime, usually. They go to prison, they learn how to be better criminals, and they get out. And we expect them to do better, you know, so they have to have some kind of incentive in order to do that. So that's what we're trying to do.
Well, I just applaud everything that you're doing. Just thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me and to share your story. I've been talking with Corey McCullough, math instructor at Merced College, PhD candidate in applied mathematics at UC Merced. Thank you so much for being on the show.
No problem.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Last year, KVPR was one of six public radio stations nationwide chosen to partner with the Personal History Project's StoryCorps on its One Small Step initiative. This year, we're happy to announce, StoryCorps is anchoring One Small Step in Fresno. That means more opportunities to record conversations between strangers with different political views in the hopes that they'll find common ground, or at least some shared humanity. This week, we're featuring two 27-year-olds, Martine and Emma. Emma is a high school English teacher, speech and debate coach, and a foster parent from Fresno. Martine is the son of immigrant farm workers who grew up in the small farming town of Stratford and now works in agriculture himself in public relations. Emma starts by asking Martine about his parents.
You are the son of immigrant farm workers. What is the thing you admire most about your parents?
To start off, my dad is one of those persons that even if it's not a popular opinion, he still does the right thing, you know, whether it be at work or whether it be at the house. So that's something I've carried on throughout my life. Overall, both of my parents, what I admire most about them is their hard work ethic. Somehow they made it work, you know, in this new country without knowing the language.
Is there a time that you can think of when you did exactly as you said your dad did, where you did what you believed was right, even though it wasn't like the popular thing to do?
I was in a situation where I had a client, bad group of workers that reminded me of my parents, you know. He was pretty harsh on them, and I stepped up and said, hey, that's not the right thing to do. You treat them with respect. They're your workers. Obviously, I ended up losing that client. I know I did the right thing because I wish someone would have stood up for my parents had they been in the same situation. How does it feel to be a foster parent?
The bureaucracy is a nightmare. It adds 15 levels of paperwork to being a parent, but I've always just wanted to provide a safe place for people whenever possible, and I felt like if I was able to be in a position where I had an extra room in my house, that I wanted that room to go to a child or children who really needed a safe place to be. And I really enjoy it. Even though it's not permanent, I like being a safe stepping stone in their lives.
Were you ever, if you don't mind me asking, were you ever a foster child?
I was not, but we lived with a lot of different relatives when I was growing up, and so like having a safe place to be for me that was just was always really important. Do you feel like people who share the same political idea as you also then misunderstand you?
Yes. I mean, that's both parties. You know, sometimes I walk into a room full of Republicans and I'm the only Hispanic in the room of like 300. And they expect me to have their same political views. But the reality is that our life experiences are what shape us. I believe as people, no political party should come before treating someone as a human.
Yeah, I agree with that too. I think there's a problem when anyone upholds their beliefs as like, these are the only ones you can believe. And if you don't, then you're against everybody and you don't believe in anything. I think that's a really narrow view. Mm-hmm. I don't want anything in the world to truly be canceled. I think we should have discourse about it. I think that there's multiple perspectives that shape everything, and I think that we should be able to see those multiple perspectives.
That is true, you know. And I see that with the issue of water every day. You know, I work in farming, so there was like a hit piece on me and my peers on ag on the LA Times. It was calling us water hogs for this, the way we irrigate, the way we feed the world. Just a year ago, we were considered heroes for keeping the supply chain going. And at the same time, our immigrant farm workers were also considered essential workers. And now we're considered the bad guys amongst urban and environmentalists for the amount of water we use. And then at the same time, you also see from the right side where it's like not wanting to talk about immigration reform when our essential heroes were the farm workers during this whole pandemic. So it gets frustrating, you know, on both sides. It's like, hey guys, we matter, we're the backbone of this country and this world when it comes to feeding people, up until it comes time for you guys to use this as a punching bag.
That's pretty similar, I think, to how teachers were treated during the pandemic. That's a really hard, like, cognitive dissonance to experience.
Was I who you expected me to be?
So reading your bio, I expected you to be like 50. So you're significantly younger than I expected.
Yeah. You know, I'm really bad at telling my own story. I'm really good at telling other people's stories except my own.
You do a really great job of talking about the people that have really influenced you, but I don't think that that's like a knock on you. I think that really shares like how tied you are to your community.
It's really that, you know, my community really defines who I am, I feel like, just because I was born and raised in that small farm town of Stratford. That was the springboard for me when my parents came to this country, ag farming, so that's why I try to share that story as much as possible.
Yeah, it's cool that you've kind of followed in their footsteps in that way.
What are your hopes for the future?
I hope that we are able to have conversations in schools that are broader and allow for students to see perspectives that mirror their own and also that share different perspectives than what they've experienced in their own lives and what they've read. And how about you? What are your hopes for the future?
My hopes for the future is that we can go back to a time where it doesn't matter what the letter next to your name, whether it be a liberal, conservative, Republican, or Democrat, we go back to treating each other as humans and with respect, you know.
I just hope that we can leave the world better than we found it.
That was Martine and Emma, One Small Step Conversation Partners at the West Fresno Branch Library. And that's today's Valley Edition. You could hear all this and more on our website, kvpr.org. You could also download the podcast and find us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. We've got an app. It's called KVPR. The show is produced by our news team, including Alice Daniel, Carrie Klein, Mathi Bolaños, and Sarith Hawk. Technical support is from Don Weaver. I'm your host, Kathleen Schock. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, ensuring the voices of Californians are heard in Californians' decisions about healthcare. On the web at chcf.org/voices.